Listening to today's program, from the moment that the Gaza operation got underway, I've been trying to find Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute. He's been a guest on the program before, and he always writes very comprehensively about what Iran is up to, and it's usually no good. In fact, it's always no good. We caught up with him today in Japan. Michael Rubin, welcome back to the program. Great to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, Michael Rubin, what do you see as Iran's role in the drama in Gaza right now?
Well, Iran has consistently, both under President Ahmadinejad and before under President Mohammad Khatami, whom many people call a reformer, worked to violently undermine the Middle East peace process. What was lost in all the reporting about the most recent outburst of violence in Gaza was that it came almost 7 years to the day after the Karin A affair, which was when the Israeli Navy intercepted a ship and which was carrying 50 tons of Iranian weapons into Gaza. Since that time in 2002 until now, Iran has only increased its aid and assistance to first to the Palestinian Authority and much more recently to Hamas.
So how deeply involved with the day-to-day operations in Hamas do you consider the mullahs of Iran to be?
This is the question which it's the key question, and it's the question which most intelligence analysts and policy analysts stew over. The question is, to what degree of operational control does Iran, what degree of operational control does Iran have over Hamas? Does Iran actually call the shots or not? I'm not so sure that question, as the intelligence community often asks it, is directly relevant. What I see is Iran giving increasingly sophisticated weaponry and financial support, and then telling Hamas, within these parameters, do what you want to do. And so whether Iran orders each Qassam rocket to be launched, or if Iran just says, here's a play bag of missiles and other lethal equipment, conduct all the terrorism you want, to me, that's what's important. I do think Hamas is an independent player, but Iran makes sure that it can do absolutely anything and everything it wants to do.
Now, Michael Rubin, last week and again today, Steve Shippert of ThreatsWatch.org has cataloged the variety of weaponry that Iran is shipping in to Gaza, including the Grad missile, et cetera, and some anti-tank weaponry and possibly some anti-helicopter weaponry, et cetera. How do they manage to pull this off? I mean, these are not small bundles of weapons.
Well, a lot of it had to do with the tunnels going in through Egypt. And this raises questions, the same questions we have about Pakistan, about Egypt, whether the leadership is saying one thing and folks in the military or others in the intelligence apparatus are doing another. What's ironic is when Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice first assumed that portfolio, when she first started as Secretary of State, her first big success, she claimed, was negotiating the Israeli withdrawal from what's called the Philadelphia Corridor, which was a narrow strip of land, only about 100 or 200 meters along the Egyptian-Gaza border, which Israel had patrolled, and indeed which Israel had been given to patrol by the Camp David Accords that were signed by Jimmy Carter. Condoleezza Rice, the Hamas and the Palestinians in Gaza demanded Israel's withdrawal. Condoleezza Rice decided to throw a bone to the Palestinians and pressured Israel to withdraw. And what happened then was the establishment of all these tunnels coming in. That's number one.
Okay.
Number two, what I find ironic is when international NGOs, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, complain about what a horrendous siege is going on in Gaza, how they can't get food and medicine, and yet they managed to get all this advanced weaponry smuggled in. I mean, it is one of the greater ironies out there.
Now, in terms of, as you assess this from afar, and obviously you're in Japan tonight, and thank you for spending some late-night time with us, Michael, what do you think Israel is accomplishing there? Do you sense that they are sending Hamas back reeling on their heels, or just another episode of border wars?
There's actually two points here. The first is Israel's immediate objective, and the immediate objective would be to push Hamas and the Palestinians back from the areas where they can launch rockets, not only at Sderot, which is an act of war in and of itself, but also to Ashkelon, where Israel has one of its largest refineries and so forth, and to other cities. That's number one. But But number two, what's most important, and I hope this is what Israeli leaders are thinking, I'm not sure, is that they need to reestablish the concept of deterrence. In the old days, the way that Israel maintained quiet along its borders was because all of its adversaries knew that if they poked Israel, Israel would poke back 100 times as hard. This concept that which we often hear on CNN and elsewhere of proportionality is just ridiculous. Now, if Israel is able to convince Hamas, the Palestinians, that you can launch a rocket at Sderot, you're going to get it much more severely in response, then that's actually the way to peace. Peace isn't made between equals. Peace is made and quiet is made when one side shows that it can roundly defeat the other.
In terms of establishing that principle, do you think that that is coming through loud and clear? And do you agree with some of the analysts who say Israel is really preparing the way for Fatah to reestablish control here and move towards a two-state solution?
The first question is, to some extent, yes. There's no doubt that both with regard to Hezbollah and that war in the summer of 2006, and also right now with regard to Hamas, Saudi Arabia and Egypt are taking a different tack than they once took. This pan-Arab bloc speaking with one voice has shown itself to be much more myth than reality this time around. That's number one. Number two, some Israeli leaders may be trying to set the groundwork for Fatah to come back. The problem is that under Hamas's stewardship in Gaza, Fatah has adjusted. It's not a secular stalwart like many people believe. It has tried to Islamize itself to appeal to the people in Gaza more, and I'm not sure whether we're just playing a game of bad cop instead of bad cop, good cop. I'm not so sure. I mean, there were missile strikes under Fatah, and when the Palestinians are faced, this has been a consistent problem. When the Palestinians are faced with accountability for their own poor governance, oftentimes black out against the other.
I'll be right back with Michael Rubin, our concluding segment on What's Up in Iran. Don't go anywhere. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show.
The Hugh Hewitt Hotline is sponsored by the franchisees of Mathnasium Learning Centers, teaching kids math the way that makes sense to them. To request parent or franchise information, call 877-MATH-201.
Welcome back, America. Thank you for listening today. I want to thank Adam Varick and Generalissimo for making it possible. I want to thank Michael Rubin, my last guest of the day from Japan tonight, expert on Iran and the mullahs there as we talk about what's ahead. We were talking about what's going on in Gaza, but let's take the go to 30,000 feet, Michael Rubin. What do you think is the situation in Iran today with oil prices plummeting before below $40 a barrel today? They must be on the ropes financially.
Oh, the Iranians absolutely are in the ropes. They plan their budget at around $90 a barrel. Most intelligence analysts believe that they can survive at around $60 a barrel. When they're below that, they are in some severe straits. What you need to do is contrast where Iran is with where the rest of the Persian Gulf states are. Take Qatar or take Kuwait. Kuwait has over $200 billion in its sovereign wealth fund. Qatar, Saudi Arabia also have these huge sovereign wealth funds. In the Iran's own press, I'm not talking about opposition reports, I'm talking about Iran's own financial papers, their own Wall Street Journal equivalent, Dunyadi Iqtisadi, they talk about how their foreign reserves are at most around $20 billion. When you have a country of 70 to 80 million people, that's a huge problem. Their inflation is skyrocketing. It's hovering around 25 to 30%, but generally, whenever you have inflation above 19%, people start to believe it's much worse than it actually is. And then they have a huge liquidity crisis. And then what's been reported, and this has the potential to be a domestic scandal inside Iran, is Ahmadinejad and various ministries have been raiding the foreign exchange reserves inside Iran, so no one in Iran really knows how much money they have left. They're facing a really tough time as they move ahead.
So if you had 5 minutes with the president-elect about the future of Iranian policy, what's your advice to him, Michael Rubin?
Number one is don't snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Iran is on the ropes. Number one, don't give them a lifeline. There's no reason why we should have an interest in preserving this regime. There's no reason, for example, why we should give them economic incentives at a time when they're on the ropes. Number two is, at the same time, we've also got to be prepared. Whenever Iran faces a domestic crisis, much like the Palestinians in Gaza, they often try to lash out and foment an external crisis. This doesn't mean that we should just ameliorate our relations with them so that they don't do this. I mean, we have enough trouble with our own economy. We don't want to have to bail out Iran's. But at the same time, we've got to be prepared that they're going to try to do something to affect our interests. It's the old Russian adage to trust but verify, except in Iran's case, you have to verify first and you have to trust a lot less.
A great cautionary note. Thank you so much, Michael Rubin. We'll talk to you when you get back to the United States. Don't go anywhere, America. Stay tuned to this radio station. We'll be back tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.